From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. That was the sound of a Russian Su-24 as it flew past the USS Ross in the Black Sea this past Saturday. The U.S. Navy ship was sailing in international waters. The part not reported here in the West is that the aircraft was flying through international airspace. The area was near Russian territorial waters. Vital food assistance destined for the Yemeni port of Aden was diverted Sunday to the port of Hodeida following reports of ongoing fighting and security threats. That, according to the UN World Food Program. The ship was en route from Djibouti with over 5,700 metric tons of food intended to protect young children against malnutrition and anemia. Earlier aid shipments of food, water, and medicine have been turned back or sent to Djibouti under the threat of bombing from U.S.-directed Saudi airstrikes. The UN estimates that at least 2,000 people have been killed in Yemen since the conflict began 3 months ago. Stephanie Kutrix has more.
WFP said on Monday the rations of food diverted from Aden after a security warning would have been enough to feed around 60,000 Yemenis for a month. It added that it will continue to try to reach the port city and surrounding areas by sending supplies from Hodeida by road. Millions of people are reportedly in desperate need of food in areas that have been inaccessible for a long time due to fighting. Speaking in French, WFP spokesperson Elizabeth Bierce said the agency does not yet have precise details on the incident.
Nous n'avons pas d'informations précises à ce moment, mais
But Ms. Beer said that most likely local authorities informed the ship it should change its route to avoid problems. WFP indicated it plans to send more food by sea in the next few weeks. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
According to local media in Yemen, the Saudis have sent large quantities of weapons and ammunition to al-Qaeda groups operating in the country. Yemeni media reports Tuesday said that Riyadh is funding and arming al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or ACAP. Journalist Mohammed Al-Attab was in Sana'a Tuesday and discussed the reports with Press TV's Bardia Honadar.
Yes, the Saudi Arabia has escalated its bombardment of Yemeni different cities, especially Sana'a and Sa'da. Sana'a has witnessed today the bombardment of the leadership, of the military leadership here in the at the downtown of the capital Sana'a, where densely populated areas. So far, the civilians are the main victims of such air bombardments, as well as the when they are also targeting, as you can imagine, the mountain of Nuqom, where thousands of houses are there. The civilians are being targeted in everywhere in the country. So far, these kinds of escalations that are targeting the military positions in the densely populated areas is banned by the international laws and norms. So far, nearly at least 4,000 civilians have been killed during these air bombardments. And so far, the Saudi Arabia continues to extend its war on Yemen as they are supporting al-Qaeda in different Yemeni cities in order to wage this kind of sectarian war among Yemenis. But so far, such attempts have failed in different Yemeni cities, and the army and the Ansar Allah have already captured most of these cities and also defeated these elements of al-Qaeda. Many observers wonder what's the relation between the Saudi Arabia and the al-Qaeda, as nowadays the such a relation has been exposed, especially when these terrorist elements have been also released from prisons in Aden and Hadramaut. So they are being supported by the Saudi-led war in Yemen. They are being supported with the weapons and also cash of munitions in different Yemeni cities in order to have this kind of the what the observers say the new agendas in the Arab world in order to to have this kind of divide and roll. So far, Yemen has proved itself that it's not going to be divided. Yemenis are now united more than ever. They are now waging a retaliatory war and battles against the Saudi Arabia, which has attempted to divide Yemen. So far, they have launched a new wave of missiles into the deep territories of Saudi Arabia. These kinds of attacks and also developments on the borders with Saudi Arabia has made Saudi Arabia to have this kind of mediation, and also it has sent Oman in order to have new kind of they are expected to bow down before the Yemenis' strength and patience. Yes, they have bombarded Yemen for over 60 days, but so far they haven't achieved their goals. Yemenis also, they have revealed new missiles. They are called the Zilzal or the Earthquake, which has bounded Saudi cities in Najran, Asir, and also in the Dhahran al-Janoub. So Yemenis are expecting to have this kind of a long-term ceasefire if Saudi Arabia has understood that the Yemeni lesson that has been taught by Yemeni soldiers in the borders. Yemenis do not want to wage a war any other countries, like to live in peace and harmony with all of the people of the world.
Iraqi Prime Minister Haider Abadi said Tuesday that there was a lack of support from the international coalition in the fight against Islamic State insurgents. Speaking in Paris, Abadi said the coalition partners were not providing Iraqi air forces with sufficient air intelligence to stem the IS advance, and that support for ground operations was also lacking.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The situation in the Dominican Republic continues to be serious. That is why we welcome the additional efforts which are being made in the OAS today to enlarge and to strengthen the efforts to find a peaceful settlement there. We continue to give our full support to Secretary General Mora in his outstanding service under existing OAS resolutions. But we share his judgment that a very strong and sustained effort is going to continue to be needed. Meanwhile, I have been advised today by General Alvin, the Commander-in-Chief of the Inter-American Force, and by Lieutenant General Palmer, the Deputy Commander of the Inter-American Force, that conditions in the Dominican Republic will now permit the further withdrawal of the United States military personnel from Inter-American Force. This recommendation has the concurrence of Secretary General Mora and Ambassador Bennett. I am therefore accordingly ordering the immediate withdrawal of one battalion landing team of United States Marines, plus headquarters and supporting personnel. This will total approximately 2,000 people.
That was then U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson at a White House press conference 50 years ago on June 1st, 1965, discussing the U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic that he had ordered a few weeks before. The U.S. occupied the country for more than a year afterwards and left behind a brutal dictatorship that had been installed by Washington. Dr. Gerald Horn is an author and educator. He holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He holds a Ph.D. from Columbia and a J.D. from the University of California at Berkeley. Professor Horn, so 50 years ago, the U.S. invaded and occupied the Dominican Republic. President Johnson portrayed it one way. Tapes of his conversations with his deputy ambassador there and his Secretary of Defense and others tell a different story. And it was the first time something that some reporters called the Johnson Doctrine appeared, where the U.S. used the OAS for cover when it went in. You want to tell us about the Dominican Republic, some history, some context, and maybe how all this fits into what's going on today?
Well, first of all, you cannot understand this aggression against the DR some 50-odd years ago without understanding the anti-communist hysteria and background that had accelerated, particularly after the triumph of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. And keep in mind that 1965 was also the year in which the U.S. war of aggression in Vietnam escalated. At the same time, I think that we should try to understand some of the historical background of the Dominican Republic, which, as you know, shares the island that's oftentimes referred to as Hispaniola with Haiti. You may know that in 1844, the Dominican Republic seceded from Haiti. As I note in my forthcoming book on this question, this was an early successful attempt at U.S. covert intervention into the internal affairs of a sworn foe, that is to say, the Haitian revolutionaries, the Black Jacobins. That is to say that Washington, under Secretary of State John Calhoun, fundamentally armed rebels in the eastern half of Hispaniola, who then waged war against Haiti in order to effectuate a successful secession, which in many ways mirrored the secession that took place a couple of decades later, attempted by the so-called Confederate States of America. Keep in mind as well that after this successful secession, the U.S. administration under then President Ulysses S. Grant attempted to annex the Dominican Republic, and then after that annex Haiti to become a state, and then deport and ship the newly freed U.S. Negroes there, that is to say the newly freed slaves there. After that, there were a number of interventions in the internal affairs of Haiti, including a successful U.S. Intervention from 1915 to 1934, in which the United States military fundamentally occupied Haiti. And then even before that, there were successful interventions in the internal affairs of the Dominican Republic, including taking over the customs houses of the Dominican Republic so that New York bankers could be paid. You should also know that the Dominican Republic, since the successful attempt at seceding from Haiti, had been characterized by a kind of white supremacist politic that was very similar to that obtaining in the United States of America. You may know that approximately 70 to 80 odd years ago in the 1930s, that the dictator of the Dominican Republic, Trujillo, massacred thousands upon thousands of Haitians. And even to this very day, as you know, there's an ongoing question as to whether or not Haitians, who at least in the Dominican mythology are characterized as being darker skinned, but have been living in the DR for decades, can be characterized as Dominican citizens. So in order to understand this intervention launched by President Johnson 50-odd years ago, in which he said that there was an attempt by so-called communists to seize power, you have to understand this racial, political, and historical background.
And then there's the anti-communism aspect of it that Johnson was citing, because after the coup against Bosch, took about a year and a half for it to really start cooking, but the people went in the streets and started to take over the country, and they, in many cases, were being led by communists.
Oh, clearly so. I mean, the Dominican Republic, and in fact Haiti too, have a long and glorious history of radicalism, particularly communist radicalism. But to fast forward to the present, it's important to note that U.S. policy, despite the collapse of the Soviet Union, has hardly changed one iota, despite the fact that supposedly these interventions of aggression were driven by alleged Soviet fishing in troubled waters, to use the cliche of that era.
Right, and that's the thing. This was an indigenous communist movement. It had nothing to do with the Soviet Union, and yet it was portrayed as a geopolitical issue with the Soviet Union.
This also ties in to hysteria in Washington about what it routinely characterizes as its backyard. Not only have there been the repeated attempts to overthrow the Cuban Revolution, we all know that approximately 30-odd years ago, there was the successful U.S. intervention in Grenada that ousted an ally of Cuba. I'm speaking of the Grenadian revolutionaries. And we all know that today, as we speak, there's growing and gathering hysteria in Washington about the fact that relations in the Americas between China and the independent and sovereign members of the Organization of American States is tightening. It's interesting to note as well that despite the fact that OAS, Organization of American States, cover was used in order to justify the intervention by thousands of U.S. Marines in the DR, the Dominican Republic, the Organization of American States is in the process of changing.
Oh, yeah.
This was marked just weeks ago when in Panama you had a meeting of hemispheric leaders where finally you had a meeting after decades of isolation between the leader of Cuba, speaking of Raul Castro, and U.S. President Barack Obama. But it has to be recognized that this meeting was not an act of charity on the part of the United States,
as
oftentimes been characterized. It was fundamentally a recognition by the United States that the balance of forces hemispherically is changing to the detriment of the United States, not least because OAS states are exercising their sovereignty by tightening relations with both Beijing and Moscow. And that is helping to drive U.S. policy in the hemisphere, contrary to what you may hear in the mainstream press.
And not only that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression of the new OAS, essentially, is that it consists of only three states, UNASUR, the United States, and Canada.
It is true that under the leadership of Cuban revolutionaries, that there have been a number of attempts to establish independent bodies in this hemisphere that fundamentally exclude the United States and Canada. This is yet another reason why Washington has scrambled to not be overtaken by events by seeking to now re-engage the states of the Americas, because it was being isolated and excluded. That is to say, it reminds me of the final years of apartheid, where fundamentally the ANC, which had been jailed, had actually become the jailer of the apartheid regime. The United States had sought to isolate revolutionaries in Cuba, not least, but found that it itself was being isolated, and therefore that called for a 180-degree reversal.
Right. That's right. I mean, once you try to isolate each and every country on the planet, you end up standing in a corner by yourself. And that's been the practice. You saw an illustration of this in Peru last week or the week before, for example. The United States, the Senate, everybody's scrambling for this fast track for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And there was China's foreign minister in Peru working out business deals, including, okay, you guys can be the Pacific side of our transcontinental railroad.
That is a very important point that you raised. This proposal for a railroad from Brazil on the Atlantic coast through the Amazon to Peru on the Pacific coast, in many ways, presents a threat to the Panama Canal, which heretofore has been dominated by the United States, despite Panamanians' ascension towards sovereignty of that canal some years ago. You may also know that in neighboring Nicaragua, Chinese interests are in the process of building a canal from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Pacific to the Atlantic. And this too represents a threat to the Panama Canal, which, of course, means it represents a threat to port cities such as Savannah and Charleston and Galveston, Houston, which have been investing in infrastructure on the basis that the Panama Canal would stand unchallenged forevermore. That particular presumption is increasingly being challenged.
Yeah, we're talking basically state-sponsored monopoly capitalism. Now there's some competition out there. These free marketers should love that.
Well, hypothetically and theoretically, but we all know that these folks' principles are, shall we say, flexible.
Right. If it's my market, then it's free, and if it's in play, then it's not free. Going back to the DR intervention, so Johnson explains it as, you know, within the Cold War context, and also to protect the freedom of the people in Dominican Republic against the, you know, communist invasion, essentially, or the communist error. And as he sends in the troops saying that they're going in to save lives, they killed like 3,000 people. Is this a common exercise also for the United States in such actions?
Yes, it is. And once again, it's interesting to revert to history. You may know that during the bad old days of slavery in the United States, you had thousands upon thousands of those then characterized as U.S. Negroes who migrated from the hellhole that was the United States to the northern coast of what was then Haiti and then became the Dominican Republic after 1844. However, what's striking is that after they had migrated to what they thought would be sanctuary, you found that U.S. slave traders, who then were hegemonic and bringing enslaved Africans to the island of Cuba, then began conspiring to resuscitate slavery in the eastern side of Hispaniola, slavery that had been abolished by the Haitian revolutionaries after they seized power on that island. And so you had this very gruesome prospect that was facing these migrants. Fast forward to 1965 and the aggression by U.S. Marines and the Dominican Republic, you find that once again, violence is being inflicted upon the residents of the Dominican Republic. And just as in the 19th century, there was this idea that the northern coast of the Dominican Republic was essential to the national security of the United States of America, because the northern coast of the Dominican Republic has some of the finest harbors and natural ports that exist in this hemisphere. And historically, there had been an effort by Washington to control these harbors and ports. And that was part of the underlying reason, not only behind the secession that created the DR in 1844, but also the U.S. intervention in 1965.
And like the earlier interventions, the 1965 intervention, of course, changed the conditions under which the people of the Dominican Republic lived. They were asserting a communist revolution, essentially, or in any event, a democratic revolution, because there were, you know, it was a number of different factions within the people standing up, and a lot of it spontaneous, just against conditions. What happened to the people of Dominican Republic in the aftermath of the invasion and occupation?
Well, as you probably know, there has been a strong left-wing movement in the Dominican Republic. And as has happened throughout the world, after those described as communists were smashed, this did not smash radicalism altogether. What arose in its wake was a substantial and strong social democratic party in the Dominican Republic, which, as you know, has challenged for power intermittently in the decades since 1965. It's a party that historically had been led by those who were darker skinned, and therefore the allies of the United States in the DR characterized this as a Haitian-led party in order to defeat and destabilize these social democratic forces in the DR. Yet despite their attempt to do so, these forces still maintain a certain foothold in the politics of the Dominican Republic, and I dare say will be challenging for power throughout this century.
How do you see the developments there, say from here going forward, in relation to the integration project that's been going on in Latin America and the Caribbean?
Well, as you probably know, historically, relations between revolutionary Cuba and the DR have been strong. And in fact, if you look at the wars of independence that were fought in the late 19th century by Cubans, you will find fighting on the side of the Cubans a number of Dominicans. You may also know that after the coming to power of the Cuban Revolution in 1959, the Cuban revolutionaries extended solidarity and support to the Dominican revolutionaries. And in fact, this outraged Trujillo, who was still in power, the dictator. And in fact, when Trujillo was killed shortly after the triumph of the Cuban Revolution, it was suspected widely that Washington had a hand in this, even though he had been a convenient right-wing friend of Washington, because they felt that he could no longer contain the progressive and revolutionary and radical movement that had been energized by the Cuban Revolution. But that particular thought, that particular scenario, obviously proved unavailing when Washington had to intervene itself with Marines in 1965 to once again try to control and contain a typical upsurge of radicalism in the DR.
We close today's newscast with this commentary from Kenneth Hartman for Prison Radio.
America's punishment addiction. The broader public got a look at the uglier side of their heroes in blue when those sworn to protect and serve showed up in Ferguson in armored personnel carriers, dressed out in full combat gear, with snipers pointing high-powered rifles at unarmed civilians. Many people were shocked to see such a disproportionate show of force. I must admit that what surprised me the most was how surprised other folks seemed to be. Surely the great body public hasn't forgotten the lessons of the last generation already. In the 60s and the 70s, the government made a show of force that included gunning down unarmed students when the social order threatened to unravel. And of course, for someone on this side of the electric fences, the use of deadly force is just a fact of life. Prisoners, much more so than any other group in this country, are deemed killable. We are also deemed deserving of the infliction of pain and suffering. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled, time and again, that prisoners are not worthy of the rights of other citizens, of other humans for that matter. We can be locked into solitary confinement cells for years based on an unsubstantiated allegation. We can be denied contact with our loved ones forever for being unwilling to submit to the terrorism of stripping naked. We can be strapped down and forcibly administered mind-melting drugs on the word of one of their bought and paid for shrinks. Worst of all, and this is done routinely and without the merest fanfare, we can be sentenced to die in prison without any real hope of getting out for any number of things. This country has embraced the practice of excessive punishment with pretty much no serious dissent. Men and women are sent to prison to serve terms that defy logic, that stretch out beyond the horizon of natural life, that neither achieve restitution nor justice in any meaningful way. After serving more than 35 years for killing a man in a drunken, drugged-up fistfight back when I was 19 years old, I have long-term perspective. When I came to prison in California, the average time served for murder was 12 years. Today, that number is well north of 25 years. Back then, the overall return-to-prison rate for parolees was about 24%. Today, it's more than 70%. The expectation of a prison sentence then was rehabilitation and release. Nowadays, the expectation is pain, suffering, and death inside. The era of mass incarceration ought to be over, as it's been proven a dismal failure, but it's not. That it's not is nothing short of a tragedy and a travesty. The fact is, we live in a country that can't seem to get over the idea that only through the infliction of pain can justice be served. I think it's fair to say we've got a real problem, and it's time for an intervention. The only thing that will break the stranglehold of the punitive spirit is the active participation of the public demanding that the infliction of pain and suffering being done in their name by their servants come to an end. That desperately needed intervention has to come from out there. This is Kenneth E. Hartman, Executive Director of the Other Death Penalty Project, from inside California's prison system.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Thanks to John Doty for that little bit of music. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.